I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to episode 15 of Get to the Good Stuff with Jack Skipper. My guest this week is the legendary DJ Fat Tony. We have a very interesting in-depth chat. It does go a bit deeper than the previous episodes. You know, we touch on subjects like addiction and mental health. I mean, he does talk about shitting himself as well, so it's... It's still on brand, but no, it does go a bit deeper than previous episodes. But I think that's what this podcast is about. It's about, you know, cutting the bullshit, just getting straight to it, just be honest and authentic. And that's definitely what you do get from Tony. If you haven't read his book yet, I recommend it. It's he's got a what an interesting life, and he explains it so well. But anyway, that's enough from me. Let's get to the good stuff.
Doesn't sound like the usual mindless, boring, getting to know you chit chat. That sounds like you actually have something to say.
Well,
why are we having these conversations?
What the hell am I doing here?
Now,
everyone tells you, I get stopped like so many times a day now, literally like 20, 30 times a day if I'm in the West End, non-stop. And people will always go to you, oh, your book's so funny. I'm like, what chapter are you on? And chapter 5 or 6. I'm like, okay, I'll speak to you in a few weeks, mate. Message me on after you read it, because it gets really dark really quick, because it goes in. Do you know what I mean?
Because that's the way to do it, though, isn't it? Is it recorded? But that is the way to start them off light, get them on side.
Of course.
So it's got to be what?
But that's why I started with shitting myself straight away with the book, because I just thought, okay, let's give them where we're going with this.
Let's not
try and lead them around the garden above thinking this is going to be like a walk in the park, because it's not. But you know, very little happens when you're 3.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like when you get to 10 and 20 and 15 and 16, that's when real drama happens. Do you know what I mean? In everybody's lives. When you're 3 and 4, you don't really do anything of your own doing. Do you get what I'm saying, Jar?
You did, but you did have that thing, and like from listening to the book, that thing of like, when you talk about your brother and that thing of like being a fucker to him.
Oh, he's a cunt, yeah.
But you being a fucker to him early on, having that sort of thing.
Oh, the book ends with me being a fucker to him as well.
Where did that?
I still come, because it was jealousy.
Where does the jealousy come from, though?
Because I always wanted all the attention. It really is like an addict thing, and that's why when I was like 3 and I had a collapsed lung, I discovered at that point in time, if I was in hospital, I got attention, I got presents.
And from that
moment on, I was always ill.
But did you know that in retrospectively, or was that at the time? Can you remember that moment of going,
I can slightly remember it, but retrospectively, when you go back over it, and you just think, because I even stayed on crutches for 2 years, and I didn't need to even be on crutches because it was attention.
Do you think...
I had an operation on my foot.
Yeah.
Right, from... like, literally, from halfway down, but right the way up there.
Yeah.
Like, with, like, 100 stitches to find a bit of glass that wasn't even in there. I convinced the doctor it was in there.
As a child?
Yeah.
But I'm saying, was there a point where it was like, would you get lots of attention? Then your brother come along, and then he was like, I need that back.
Yeah.
And there was a moment of
So in my family, my older brother was always in trouble. So he wasn't really my brother. He's my half-brother. He's right. My brother, but, you know, I still like to say he's not my brother. But, yeah, he was always... So he was always in trouble. And then the little one came. There's 4 years in between us all.
Yeah.
So there's four between Kevin and me, and then 4 years between me and Dean. Yeah. When Dean came along, you know, suddenly my mum and dad weren't there. My mum, you know... And my mum had been ill around that time after that, so I blamed Dean for that as well. Yeah. So... Dean came along and suddenly it was all about the fucking baby and not about Tony. So I moved Dean underneath the phone used to be on the wall. I'd move his pram and put it underneath the phone. So the phone would ring and wake him up, stuff like that. Like literally, really worked it all out.
But that's the thing, like, I think those come across in the book that you're a piss taker.
Oh, totally, 100%. Completely.
Where's that come from, man?
I think I was born a cunt. Do you know what I mean? I really do. Do you know what I mean? It's like in me.
It never leaves you.
It doesn't.
I was going to say.
I wear it around my neck in diamonds.
Oh, yeah, you do. Yeah. You wear it well.
Well, because it's who I am. Totally suits me. But you know what? It suits me too well.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I go into that kind of mode, because I'm not really, there's so many different types of cunt. I can be a clever cunt. I can be a funny cunt. I can be a nasty cunt, but I don't like to be a nasty cunt because the only person I'm nasty to is myself.
Yeah.
I'm not nasty to other people. I will eternalise that and bash shit out myself.
I think if you are a cunt, a cunt becomes a term of endearment, doesn't it?
Oh, really?
To other cunts, you go,
of course
it is.
Yeah, you cunt.
Yeah, yeah.
You're only a cunt to the ones you love.
Of course, you're always. Always. And, you know, and you're only a cunt yourself because you don't love yourself. And like that's where it all gets very blurred. But the word cunt is like, you know, it's a lovable thing.
Everyone uses it.
It's one of those like things. Oh my god, I don't like that word. Fuck off. You're in an argument. You don't.
I think that's more of an American thing. Cunt.
Yeah.
You know, don't pretend you don't like that word because everyone likes that word.
It makes me feel
I don't shit or I don't fart. Fuck off. You don't. You know what I mean? It's like when people fart out loud and people like. Oh my god, offended by it. It's like, why are you offended by it? You do it all day long.
I think that's what the whole idea with this podcast was, to get to let's get to the good stuff. Let's get to it, because I hate the fucking about.
Yeah, we're not fucking about.
Yeah, we're not doing that. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Like, as soon as we started messaging about coming to this podcast, he was like, "Have you read my book?" I said, "No." You call me a cunt.
Yeah, of course.
I was like, "Like this guy."
What the fuck am I coming on here for? If you haven't read my book. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no,
it's a Sunday Times bestseller, you cunt.
I keep fucking saying it, Jesus Christ. But no, it is good. I am enjoying it. Do you know one thing I enjoy about it? Because I've always said, if I could go back in time, whatever, like fucking Victorian times, the Romans, I'd go back to like Acid House.
Yeah.
Because that's like...
You got to remember, we didn't have phones, we didn't have social media.
That's what I love about it.
We had to stop at a phone box to find out where we were going.
Sick, that is cool.
Do you know what I'm saying, Joe? Yeah. You only went in a phone box for two reasons. I had to make a proper phone call and call your dealer. B, or to find a prostitute on the cards that were advertising in there. Yeah. Do you know what I'm saying to you? That's how we communicate. So when you were at a party, you were actually at a party.
That's sick.
You weren't on your phone looking at everyone else at another party. You weren't messaging everyone saying, "Where are you? I'm going to come and meet you." You were actually in the moment. And that was the difference between now and then.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying to you? Then we were in the moment.
And how's that make you feel about
now?
No
one is ever in the moment.
Does that make you sad?
I do think that most people miss about 70% of what's going on around them.
Because of
social media. They're all constantly on there looking at what everyone else is doing. And they forget what they're doing. They forget where they are. They don't take it in. You know, you go to a concert and you see everyone standing there filming the concert.
Yeah.
And looking at their phones, filming the concert, and not actually watching the concert. So what they're doing is they're already put this thing in front of them and what's really going on.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Just put your phone down. If you want to film it, put it on a fucking tripod. Just sort of stick it against a wall and film it. But just be in the moment, because that's why you're there. You've travelled all the way to Wembley or the O2, right?
Yeah.
From wherever it is you live, miles away. You get there, whoever it is comes on stage, Elton John, for instance, he's on, out comes the phone, straight up. You might as well have stayed at home and got someone else to film it for you.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because you're missing the magic.
Are you conscious of doing that now when you're out enjoying yourself? Do you think, how do I?
Yeah, I don't really do that when I go out that much. I kind of, most of mine's done at home when I'm sitting on the sofa. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah.
Or, you know, that. But when you're out and about, It really pisses me off in clubs more than anything when people are just filming you. Don't get me wrong, it's what we do, it's the world that we live in. And yes, the more people see you doing what we do, what you do, the better, right?
Yeah.
I ain't got a problem with that. I love social media. But what it does do is it detaches from where you're at.
100%.
You know, you're constantly filming. You're not feeling the music.
Especially something like a DJ set. There's not even much performance to even watch anyway. So you've got to be in
sometimes
there.
Sometimes you're there and you've got like 400 camera phones in your face.
Yeah.
And literally just want to say to people, guys, put it down. Come
yeah,
on.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
When was that moment in your life where, as a young man, where it was like, music, this scene is just, this is a bit of me.
Oh, the first time I ever went to a nightclub, the first time I walked into the Embassy Club, I was shagging this guy called Roy. And I was shagging Roy. Roy lived in Battersea, and I met him in a public toilet, actually, in Battersea.
Oh, that Roy.
Yeah, that Roy. You know the one, Jack. That's why you're wearing baby blue. He was a manager at the Embassy, and I was 14, and I turned up at the club, and I walked in, and I thought, I've arrived.
Yeah.
That was it. That magical moment. I just thought, this is going to be my life from now on.
Yeah.
I just literally, I loved the energy, the lights, the thumping music. I was always drawn to that. I was always drawn to the night. I loved the nighttime. I didn't like daytime.
Was that the
FX?
Early 80s, was that then?
Yeah.
Early 80s. What was the music then when you was?
So it was very electro. Then.
Right.
Very, very electro. It was just on that cusp. So like New Romantic would just come in. So there was a lot of electronic music.
Right.
But you know, for me to walk into there and just think, oh my God, this is everything I've ever wanted.
How old were you, sorry?
I was 14, 14? 15, yeah.
So that was like, was drugs big then at that time? Or not?
Cocaine and Smack. Smack kind of really got a grip of London in about 3 years later. Everyone was on Smack.
It's not a club in drug though, is it? Or?
No, but it got London by the balls. There was a real major epidemic in the early 80s, mid 80s.
So where would they do it? In clubs?
Well, the people would be doing it in clubs and they'd go home, or they'd be doing it at home and not get into the clubs.
Right,
there's a really famous line where someone, I think it was Mark Almond, said that cocaine will always get you ready for the party, but it won't get you to the party.
Right.
And it's so fucking true.
Yeah.
The amount of times I've had people in my house waiting for me to get ready to go out, and suddenly it's 4 o'clock in the morning and I'm still trying, throwing clothes everywhere.
Yeah.
And I'd go down there and it'll be like, the club's shut now. I'm like, oh, well, we have to stay in there.
Yeah.
But literally always, because I'd just be so power about going out the house.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So the love and that feeling, it came for clubbing first. That
first was like, of all.
That was it.
Straight away. I never ever wanted to be a DJ. I never ever set out to be a DJ. There was always a love of music in my house, always on a Sunday, man.
Yeah.
My dad would play. My dad was one of these people that had to have the best of everything.
Right.
So he had the best stereo system. Yeah. Marantz.
Was he a geezerish?
Yeah, my dad was 6'3", yeah. Fingers like bananas. Yeah. He was a plumber from Pimlico. He was like, you know, he's a fucking big man, very big man. And, you know, everything about him was big. His attitude, the way it was. My dad taught us. You know, if we come home from school and I'd be crying because I got bullied at school or whatever, my dad would fucking drag me up to school, find out he's bullying him, and make me fight them.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, always.
How did he react to you being gay?
Never had a problem with it.
Never had a problem?
Never had a problem with me being gay. He never ever discussed it. Never had a problem with it. You know, when you've got people like Boy George turning up at your house when you're like 15, you know, in full
15,
out.
15? Boy George turned up?
Yeah, 15, 16. Yeah, 16, around 16, actually. You know, my dad never really... I was leaving the house at 14 in drag. Do you know what I mean? Just to rebel such. And my dad never just, like, look at me and go...
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
But it is,
my
dad it is was more, the norm, though, isn't
but,
it?
Yeah, of course it is. But my dad was more concerned about me being beaten up or me being attacked for who I was. That's what he had a problem with.
Because you are quite tough, you are resilient, quite
I am,
hard,
yeah.
Aren't you?
But my dad was...
concern,
you know,
for your safety rather than
what you were, what other people were capable of, not what I was capable of. Do you know what I mean?
Well, that's love.
Yeah,
you know. And I used to say to him, Dad, no one's going to mess with a 6 foot fucking five drag queen. You know what I mean? I used to wear 6 inch heels. I was already 6 foot at that age. You know, it was like I was bigger than anyone.
Yeah.
But you know, that's what he was more concerned with. He didn't really have a problem with me being gay. He had a problem with other people thinking that I was gay. That's what he had a problem with.
So did you? You know, there's the. Oh, by the way, I can only hear about what other people tell me about the struggles of coming out and all that sort of thing. Was it not in your house?
Never had to come out in my house. No.
Never had to.
No, I mean. The the thing about my mum and dad was, when they first met, my mum was from King's Road and my dad was from Pimlico. Right? My mum come from the posh part. She's quite up the junction-ish, you know, that film from the 60s where the posh girl wanted to be poor, so she hung out with her. That's kind of like my mum and my dad.
Yeah, yeah.
My dad was a bit rough as far as she was concerned. But they met in a lesbian club called The Gate in King's Road.
Right.
Back then it was like an unheard of place, but every, you know, unless you knew it, and that's where they met. So they never really had a problem with it.
Open-minded people.
They were like, really were. You know, my mum was a part of the swinging 60s, and my dad was too. My dad had a quiff all his life. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, that's who my dad was. But you know, he never really had a problem with it at all.
So when
I had a problem with it, he didn't. Yeah. Problem with everything.
Yeah, but wait. So when it was like the clubbing, so it was the love for the clubbing, and then what, did you start DJing straight away, or was it just you was a part of the scene?
No, because I was just part of the scene. So I used to go to this one club on a Tuesday night called Cha Cha's, which was at the back of Heaven. Then it kind of progressed on to Heaven and other clubs. But then, you know what it was I went out every night of the week.
Right.
'Cause I lived in Battersea.
Yeah.
So I literally lived a bus ride from the West End. I was so hook, line and sinkered into Soho.
Right.
Loved everything about Soho. It was in my blood. My aunt had done those streets many a year when she was on the game, and my other auntie had a brothel there, and you know, all of that stuff that went on. So I was just, it was in my blood, and you know, I'd just be out every night of the week, and then I had the biggest mouth possible, like I'd blag everything, literally.
Yeah.
And then one night I was at a club working on the door, which I'd blagged. This guy, Steve Strange and Russ Egan, who basically run.
Steve Strange?
Yes, he was like the face of the New Romantic era and that. They were doing a new night at the Lyceum Ballroom, which is now where the Lion King is. Right. Big place, fucking place, right? So they did this, they started this new Saturday night, and I went up to, I remember going to Rusty and his office and going, yeah, well, you're opening a new night in here, and he was like, yeah. I said, I'm doing one the same night. And he was like, what? I was like, I'm opening one the same night, on Saturdays. And he was like, where? And I said, I can't tell you that. And I remember the conversation and him being like, well, why don't you come and work for us instead of going up against us? And I was like, I'll think about it.
And I
remember leaving thinking, yes. Stop myself a job. So they gave me a job working the door. I was like the picker. And I'd sit there and I'd give away free tickets to everyone each week and let them all in. And then every week I would say, everyone's leaving. And he'd be like, right, why? And I'd be like, because the music's shit. And Rusty was a DJ himself. That's what he was famous for. And I was like, everyone's leaving. And I remember this guy called Ian Dewhurst, who was like the DJ of the time.
Yeah.
And for some unknown reason, I had a real problem with him because he was successful, I think.
Yeah, right? Sounds like you.
And I think he'd been rude to me one night. Yeah, you know what I mean? And I was like, phew. And I was literally that every time he comes on, everyone leaves. So one week, Rusty said, if you could do better, you fucking do it. And I was like, all right, I will. And that was it. And next
week, you knew how to mix and all that, or you just...
No,
you just blank?
No. I've only just learned to do that. But no, like literally all that time, you know, it was just about playing records. It was about knowing what to play, knowing what to put on, knowing how to read a dance floor.
Yeah.
And that's been the secret to my sex, because I've always read a dance floor and I've really read it well.
There is definitely a thing, isn't there? That's like I think that's a thing. I don't think that's a thing you can learn. I think that's like a thing you have, is like of being able to entertain it, because you can learn technical side of things, can't you?
Oh, listen, people can beat match, they can use their laptops. You know when someone's doing that, right? That's not DJing, that's selecting music.
Yeah.
There's a difference. And then you've got DJs that listen to music, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, listening to music, don't cut it. You need to feel music.
Yeah.
That's what makes a good DJ. You feel the music, you feel the vibe off the dance floor. When people are dancing to you, you feel that energy. That energy goes into you. If you learn how to take that energy in, then you're capable of taking that energy onto something else and building. That's what a good DJ.
I completely agree.
That's exactly what a good DJ is. Someone who sits at home selecting tunes of what they're going to play that night is a complete cunt.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Oh, this, and then they go out and they play that set in that order. You know, you're not reading a crowd, you're reading your record box.
Yeah,
that's it. Or you go a set somewhere and someone goes on before you and they've seen you on YouTube or they've seen your videos or stuff, and they play all your tunes.
Yeah, yeah.
And you think, well, why are you doing that? Because that's just silly, all like the big classic, whatever. So what that does for someone like me, that gives me drive. That thinks, okay, I'm really glad you played all that old shit. because that's comfortable. Let me go on and be uncomfortable and play all that what I want really should be played and take it to the next level, and it always works.
Nice, man.
So I have to thank those little wanky warm-up wankers that try to think they're the main headliner.
Them eight. What would you call that scene in the 80s then? What would you call that scene you was a part of? What was
it? Call it the 80s, isn't it? I mean, look, you know, it was the tail end of punk, then it was the new romantic stuff, and then after that, everyone kind of got into labels again.
Yeah.
You know, so it was kind of a real like dressing up kind of period.
Yeah, you were well young though, weren't you?
Like, me?
Yeah, like
I was 14 then, so I'm younger. I'm like 6 years younger than most of those other people that were around then.
Right.
So, like George, for instance, my best friend, he's like 62 now.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I'm 55.
Yeah.
There's a difference.
Was there a thing then of you like being like attracted to the darkness? You know, the dark side of it was just like
fuck, man.
The naughtiness.
Of course, you know. Listen, my aunt used to sit on the hill by my house, right? I'd come home from school, and she'd be lying there drinking bottles of Woodpecker cider, and throwing the bottles at the bus. I was drawn to it.
Yeah.
She was the most magical person in the world. The most magical person there was. She was like a fucking wizard. Do you know what I mean? She was like, oh my God, she's incredible. She don't give a fuck. Fighting people on the street at the bus stop for shouting at her. Like literally punching people and rolling around the grass. I loved her. I was drawn to it. Whereas my dad, who had a drink problem, I weren't drawn to that because he didn't have the insanity.
Yeah.
You give me insanity, I'm drawn to it.
Yeah,
love fucking insanity. Insane people are my favourite people.
Is that right? You like to cause the madness as well. That was
well, you know what? You know, there's people in life that draw the magic out of you, or they draw the insanity out of you.
Yeah,
I used to always be with the ones that drew the insanity out of me.
Yeah,
because I had to be more insane than them. Today it's a different thing. I like the magic more than I do the insanity.
Yeah,
but I've always been drawn to it. Always, man.
Yeah,
you know, every boyfriend, every relationship, always been insane. Right. And I could put a hand on it. They've all been mental.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because it's like for like, isn't it?
I'm just wondering if that life found you, or did you find that life though? Is there sort of attraction of it? Though? It was always going to happen. You're going to gravitate towards madness. Because what's the story? Tell what you go. You first done drugs.
Oh no, that's boring. That story now. You know what it was? I told that story as a part of a conversation. Yeah. And then it suddenly went on to be a tagline of my fucking life.
Right.
No, Freddie Mercury gave me my first line of coke.
That's pretty big, though.
Yeah, it's a major story.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? But it's one of those things that wasn't a boast. It was actually a part of a conversation. And, of course, people love to take a tagline. And it's like, the other one was for, I did this Mixed Mag documentary, and it was like, I spent over £1 million on drugs as a part of a conversation.
Yeah.
And suddenly it's like, oh my God, he's boasting. Yeah. You know,
it's like, well, I think it is a shocking thing to do, though.
Yeah, I wasn't a pools winner.
Yeah,
I didn't win the pools, and I didn't win any lottery.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? If anything, it was a failure.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That kind of spending that kind of money, or spending your life destroying everything you come into touch with, is not a win situation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And all those kind of taglines always make it sound like that you are. And I mean, that night, I was outside heaven. I was 15, stood there freezing cold all night long in a T-shirt, Fiorucci T-shirt.
Yeah.
And I stood there, and then all night long people were like walking in, and I was too scared to go in because it was a men-only thing.
Yeah.
And I was just too scared to go in. I'd already been out clubbing all the time, like at Cha-Cha's and stuff like that. Yeah. But because it was men-only, it was a different dynamics. I was really scared about it. And all these guys were all night long going, and security started taking the piss, going, "You're right, mate, what are you waiting for?" I was like, "I'm waiting for my friend."
Yeah.
And they were like, "Yeah, of course you are." And then these two old queens that worked in a coffee bar right opposite had clocked me, and then they started saying stuff. So I was getting all like, anyway, this little group of guys walked in, and they were like, "Nice t-shirt." And I was like, "Oh, thanks."
Yeah.
Like a bit like you and your baby blue.
Yeah, thanks.
You know,
thanks.
And,
I'm waiting for you to say it.
You know that. Nice t-shirt. great tits. And they said literally the same thing. And I was like, oh. And then they were like, what are you doing? And I was like, waiting for my mate. And they were like, the security guy went, no, you ain't.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, I am. And they were like, why didn't you come with us? And that was it. I didn't know who Freddie Mercury was.
How did you not know who Freddie Mercury was?
Because Queen wasn't on our playlist at home.
Right, okay.
You got to remember, there was a real gap between Queen being Queen. They had done what they did in the 70s, and then they went quiet for a while.
Right, okay.
And then they had a resurgence when they brought out I Want to Be Free and all that stuff.
Right.
I Want to Break Free. So there was this real gap in between that. And it was that the kind of talent towards that gap. So I didn't know who Freddie was. I'd heard of Queen, obviously, but no one mentioned Queen when we were in heaven.
Yeah.
And then they all say, oh, we're going back to Holland Park. Do you want to come? And I was like, yeah, I'll come.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because bearing in mind, I told my mum I was away with the scouts that weekend, and I had nowhere else to go. So
always be prepared.
You know what I mean? And I went off, I trotted. And yeah, no, that was it, really. They gave me, someone offered me a line of coke, and I was like, don't do drugs. And that was it. I kind of just did it. And I remember hating it.
But this is what I mean about, like, like you just standing there, and then Freddie Mercury comes along, you end up going back to Freddie Mercury. That's what I mean. This stuff gravitates towards you.
It does, yeah.
This weirdness.
It's happened like that all my life.
That's what I'm saying. I wonder why that... Is there an element of...
Into the mic.
Is there an element of you, like... If you would have just if you would have not gone into that club, you would have done a bit of plumber. Would madness have still happened? Do you know what I mean?
Is that your sliding doors moment, or is that one of many?
I think it's one of many. You know, listen, there's been so many of those situations, and I kind of think that though they happen for a reason. It's not just, you know, it's just like I didn't happen to suddenly stumble across that. People come into your life for a reason. And I don't know. I don't know what my destiny is or what I'm put on this earth for, but I truly believe that there's been so many of those insane moments. Like, you know, Boy George, as for instance. Yeah. I worked in a shop in Kings Road. I got kicked out of school at 14 for having sex with my drama teacher. Got thrown out, asked drama, lots of drama.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, like being... And I went and got this job in the King's Road in a newsagent's where I would steal all the money out of Teal, go down the road and buy loads of clothes from a shop called Jones, and then go back to work the next day, head to Tony, designer clothes, and no one ever...
You're just a little fucker, Tony. Right.
But when I left there, when I worked in the Great Gear Market, sold so much money every day. Like I would leave with 800, 900 quid. That's a lot of money in the 80s, you know, a day. And we'll turn up next week, and they like next day to work, and she'd be like, "You look nice." And I'd be like, "Oh yeah, thanks." Just getting away with it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Always getting away with shit in life.
So where was this nice side of you when you were there with Freddie Mercury and they're like, "Do you want drugs?" You're like, "No, I'm."
Because I didn't read drugs. Well, you know, I'd seen what drugs did to my dad and my mum and stuff like. Not my mum, but I saw my dad sort of going down that path with alcohol, and I just thought it's not for where I want to be in life. Do you know what I mean? I don't want to be beating my wife up on a Sunday morning because I drank too much scotch or any of that situation. So it wasn't really something I went to or was drawn to. But you know what? I kind of just, it was a big gap between doing that first line and then doing it every week, that's for sure.
Yeah. You know. What was the turning point there then when it started? But the lifestyle, wasn't it?
Alcohol again. Oh, alcohol. Really? Started getting really pissed and going into blackout and wanting to fight everyone.
Yeah.
And like literally, my mate would be like, look, you need to sober up, have a line of this. And I'd be like, don't want a line of that. And he'd be like, it will keep your weight longer and you can drink more. And I was like, I'll have some.
Yeah, yeah.
And anything that I thought would keep me awake longer and make me be able to drink more was a fucking win, right?
Yeah.
And that was it. Yeah. And I remember the first week I did it on a Saturday night, I was like, oh, fucking hate that. I was awake all night praying, and I thought, oh, I'll take some acid to calm down.
Like, ended up
two window panes, ended up at fucking Regent's Park Zoo, like with my mate, like off our nuts, like trying to steal rabbits and things. Yeah. But like completely, you know, and that was it. And then on the Monday, I was like, I'm never doing that again.
Yeah.
The following Saturday, exactly the same.
I think there's this funny thing though, like this little fucker who shags drama teachers, nicks things. Like, how can he get any worse? And it was like, give him some drugs.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
Let's see what happens
down
now.
With some acid.
I was drawn to that. You know, everyone would go after work to the Chelsea Pottery in Kings Road. And they'd all be like, oh, they'll be drinking snake bite. I'd be straight on the Jack Daniels.
Yeah.
So, and they'll be like, oh, it's Monday night, I'm just going to have a beer. I'll be like, triple Jack Daniels and Coke. Like, literally, just going for it.
Like, can I just ask a question? It seems like, I mean, I don't know if it's different today, but it seems like there was kind of like a circuit or a route or like there was, it seems like it was a little bit closer knit, the community.
Well, yeah, it was because you know what? London... didn't, you know, obviously you had Peckham and you had everywhere else still, they existed, but they weren't areas to hang out in.
Yeah.
There was no, the West End.
Yeah.
So it was four streets in the centre of London that had all the action on. Shoreditch was Shoreditch. Do you know what I mean? It was a rundown area of London. There was no nightlife going on there. There was no clubs there until much later on when trade opened in Clerkenwell's, when Turnmills turned into from a wine bar into a nightclub. Yeah. And it was that slow build. So the West End, everyone knew each other.
Mm.
Everyone knew each other.
Sounds quite nice. Sounds like a good thing, didn't it?
Well, also, you know, everyone had to find their own platform. Yeah. Right? You didn't have social media. You couldn't sit at home and pretend that you're a stand-up comedian by posting the same old shit day in and day out.
I don't know if it's...
No, in general. You had to find your own platform. So you had to do something. Mine was being vocal. Mine was like, in your face, wanting to fight. Literally. I mean, the first thing I ever said to George was, who does your hair? It's shit. And George was like, what? And I was like, your hair is shit. They're not dreadlocks, they're shitlocks.
You had a point.
And that was the first thing I said to him. And that was it. After that, he was like, I fucking hate you. And I was like, and that's it. We became best friends.
Yeah, kind of as well.
You know, yeah, of course. Anyone that, you know, I always used to have this theory that anyone I start off having a fight with always ends up to be my best friend.
Yeah.
Because it's always, it's that like for like thing. You see yourself in them and you think, I'm going to challenge that cunt. I'm not having him outdo me. Do you get what I mean? And off you go.
When you used to get off your head, though, did you ever have the, what have I done thing? Or did you not give a shit?
No, always.
You
on
did
the,
have
on
it.
The Tuesday, what have I done? Or, you know, when I got
Tuesday.
Tuesday was always...
Started on Wednesday.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Literally, that's what it was like. You'll hear it in the book when you get to read it properly, you can. But, like, towards the end, it was, you know, always, I would be, oh, I'm so sorry. I really didn't mean to do that. Sorry, just... came out of my mouth, like, before I'd even, like, you know, literally, it was like, oh, sorry. Yeah. You know, I was always saying sorry, and it meant nothing. But, you know, I'd always think, I can't do this anymore. And then suddenly I'd add this magical thing, which didn't happen very rarely, called sleep.
Right.
And as soon as I slept, it re-kicked in and restarted the button again. And the next day, I'd be like, I'm not drinking today.
Yeah.
Come 4 o'clock in the afternoon, already pissed.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And now off out the door again.
Did booze, like, did it... Because I have this thing, I think booze can either enhance or be a different version of someone, or just fucking changes someone.
Yeah, no. There's a chemical reaction in different people. It's a, you know, certain people get really nasty on certain spirits because that's a chemical reaction. That's an analogy. That's an you become allergic to certain things. And my dad, if he drank scotch, he got really violent. So he was allergic to scotch.
Yeah.
Right. If he drank beer, he was as happy as Larry.
Yeah.
You know, certain people I know drink anything, and they're so much fun to be around. You give them a glass of white wine, hell, do you know what I mean? That's it. So there's certain things, you know, certain levels, it's about finding where you're at. With me, I would drink fucking anything, and I thought I was the most funniest cunt in the world.
But no one else was thinking.
Oh, no, they were.
Oh, they were.
Because they wanted to be around me.
Oh, right, yeah.
Listen, and those, you know, we would just literally take the fucking piss out of everyone.
Still do, you can't.
Yeah, I do, but it's a different way now. Do you get what I mean?
It's got to stop. I'm not drunk. I think we've overdone that word.
I'm responsible. Yeah, I can. I know, yeah. When we had to do the edit of my book, I took 47 cunts out of the book. I was like, that don't need to be in there. Mike's like, but that's what you said. And I'm like, it doesn't need to be in there. Like, oi, all right, Tony, you can take it out. 47 were removed.
Well, cap ours now.
The publishers were very happy with the 47 removed, yeah.
There was some... I bet you probably haven't got an answer for it, but is there like one bender where that was a big one? That was like...
me, you mean? I'm the biggest bender.
Oh, yeah, not like that. One session.
Yeah. What did you just call me?
She got really offensive.
Clip it up.
Did you fucking just call me? Do you know what I mean? I don't come here to get homophobically abused. Do you know what I mean?
Liar.
I'm not the one wearing baby blue, Jack.
I need to clarify that question. Was it one session?
Yeah.
No.
That, you don't remember?
There were so many.
Or was it like a 20-year?
I mean, look, you know, it's 28 years of using and abusing.
Was it,
the first 10 were kind of fun. And the last 18 weren't fun at all. There was magical moments all the way along, don't get me wrong. There were certain bits. But there were so many times where... it would go on and go on, and I'd end up in fucking A&E or in like secure units because there's one time where I was in a club called Fred's, which was a private members club in Soho, and I left there and I suddenly found myself in Liverpool Street Station. Right. I lived in Brick Lane at the time,
right.
And I was running round Liverpool Street Station, chasing my mates, and. Literally, they're all, and I'd go out and they're all sitting in the car, and I was banging on the car window, let me in, come on, I want to get in. They weren't there. And they were all morphing into walls.
Whoa.
They were behind, like, I remember being at one point in the road, banging on the car window, and this guy gets out, and I'm like, let me in, come on, we've got to go. And he was like, and I was like, Danny, and it suddenly wasn't Danny. And then I remember this guy coming up to me going, you're mental, mate, you're absolutely mental. I remember him saying it to me, and I was like, fuck off, who are you? Literally, it took me about, I was there for about 2.5 hours, And I got home, the police found me, took me to my house.
Yeah.
We had these big gates outside the house, these metal gates. And all my friends were standing behind the gates, laughing at me and wouldn't let me in. And I was like, please let me in. The police had driven off. They just dumped me out of the car and couldn't wait to get rid of me.
Yeah.
And I remember standing there, like, going, let me in, let me in. And they were all morphing into the walls. It was just bizarre.
Yeah.
And what happened was I ended up in bed and I was eating soup in bed. And my boyfriend came in and went, what are you doing? I was like, I'm having soup. He was like, you do realise there's nothing there, right? And I was like, what? And I was literally eating. And I was going, come with me, ask them. And there was a big party going on in my living room. Like, there was about 30 people. And I was having conversations with them. I was sitting with them, getting them drinks and everything.
Is that what psychosis is?
They weren't there.
Well, drunk. It got by drugs or drink?
Yeah,
or
was it by both. I think it was the lack of sleep, and I think it was like, you know, I'd like to think someone spiked my drink, which was always a good excuse for everything.
Yeah.
But no one's spiking my drink, not the people I hang around with. They were too tight.
Spiking your own drink.
Do you know what I'm saying to you? And it literally went to that level. And I kind of just thought, I'm never going to come back. I remember laying down and opening my eyes and jumping out of bed, and we had, the bed was up by the ceiling. It was like up, built on stilts.
Yeah.
And I jumped out and I knocked myself out on the floor. I came around the hospital and I remember them saying, look, you know, you need to go to, we're going to put you into a secure unit for your own safety. Because they thought I tried to kill you. Yeah.
Fucking hell, man.
And of course, you know, I'd leave those places, leave hospital and go home. And I'm out again, the door straight away.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as I had a story to tell, that was it.
So was the 80s more sort of like partying and not abusing the stuff?
The 80s was more booze.
Yeah.
The 90s, at the end of the 80s, we went into acid house, which was a fucking amazing time in London, man. Around the world. You know, ecstasy changed everything. Changed absolutely everything. You know, I'd slept with half the ACF, the ICF, before before the end of the middle of the 90s, the inner city firm, the ICF, I'd slept with half of them before the 90s because of ecstasy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, literally, the biggest football hooligan.
Fucking hell.
Like, oh, coming out to me and, like, you know, I had one boyfriend, I won't say his name, he used to come around my house and put a gun in my mouth and, like, fucking mental. And, like, then he'd go off, oh, I've got to go meet the missus and stuff. Like, completely insane.
Fucking hell.
Yeah, like, you know, because that was all due to, because of ecstasy and acid house.
Yeah.
Acid house changed a lot of people's.
I didn't know it did that.
It did. Because you know what happens? They really open people up.
Yeah, yeah.
It was really clean drug. And then suddenly that as people decided to change recipes and make things their own and start selling it again.
Yeah.
Because the first ecstasy we used to take used to come from New York.
Right.
And it was so, we used to get in little brown bottles and we'd put like five dots and do a dice. It was insane. And you'd get that shutter vision.
So is this late 80s, early 90s? That.
No, this is,
So what was it? That, what was it? That, like, was not, weren't tablets brown, then?
No, it weren't tablets. We just get grand bottles.
Right.
And we'd do little five dots on our hand and snort it, and then we'd get shutter vision where everything was like, and you'd get like, you know, that feeling was insane.
Well, so nothing is like that, like that since?
Nothing ever was like that after that.
Right.
You know, it all started suddenly getting cut or suddenly getting, the recipe got changed.
Yeah.
It was really good for about 6-7 months.
I mean, was that, because obviously, you just explained all this, the dark times and all the mental shit that was going on. But was that like, was there sort of good, just mainly good memories of that sort of time?
Oh, of course there was.
Yeah.
Listen, the first, you know, I'd go up to people I fucking hated and say, I love you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm really sorry I was horrible to you. I'm really sorry I cut your girlfriend's hair off or whatever.
Yeah.
You know? Like, literally just insane.
Yeah.
And they'd be like, oh, yeah, you're all right, you know. And then it was like the drugs would wear off and you'd think the next day, fuck it, an hour.
Yeah.
Or you'd wake up with someone in your house and you'd think, what the fuck is he doing here?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
That's like one of the biggest things. Like, it's like a rebellion type thing, wasn't it?
Acid House was a rebellion.
Yeah.
You know, we'd just been gone through the Thatcher years and suddenly we had, being a gay man, we'd gone into like No Clause 28 and we'd gone into all of these things and we'd gone into poll tax riots and everything else that went on.
Yeah.
You know, we were being most oppressed, you know, people in the world. Our country was fucking on the brink, like it is again at the moment.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
We should bring back some of that ecstasy. Get some more of that stuff.
We need an acid house.
Yeah. Let's do it.
We need that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we need, that's exactly what we need. We need an acid house explosion.
Yeah, yeah.
We need something along those lines where we find freedom again.
Did it feel like that at the time? Did it feel like this something's happening?
Yeah, it really was. You know, suddenly we've gone from these small parties to actually these massive fucking fields
of
50,000 people.
Yeah.
You know,
was there only good stuff happening in them parties as well? Because if everyone's all loving, then that's
yeah, it really was. And then suddenly, what happens is when some things, what happens is it's like nature, right? Something grows, it becomes really, you know, small, and suddenly it gets bigger and bigger, and suddenly it becomes really beautiful.
Yeah.
Right. Then it has to die.
Right.
Right. For something new to go, and that's exactly what happened with Acid House. It got really big, really quick. It was amazing, and then suddenly started to wilt and die because it got criminalized. It got criminalized really
Gangsters
quickly.
Start making money out of it, basically.
Totally. Let's put on this rave. Let's get that one on. Yeah, and I would find myself working for the biggest scum under the, on the planet that weren't in it for the music and weren't in it for what Acid House stood for. They were in it to make money.
Yeah.
And they would put on these big events, charge everyone and treat people like shit, you know. Yeah. There would be guns suddenly arrive in, as I said. And it, just the whole feeling changed. And suddenly the drugs started getting cheaper and cheaper in the sense of what they were cutting them with.
Wasn't
and people started dying.
Didn't the government start shutting it down?
Yeah, then? Because it got so big.
Because of that, so there was a reason to shut it down. Then.
It was organised crime very quickly.
I always thought it was like a thing of like they
the
couldn't handle
the criminal justice bill, wasn't it?
Yeah. I always thought it was more of a thing that they couldn't handle it.
They couldn't handle it. But they, you know, they shut the motorways down and stuff like that because of these raves. I mean, there were times when I used to have to go cross country with my record boxes.
Yeah.
Not on my own, of course, but like with people carrying the record boxes, of course. But yeah, because you want to hurt my hands. But I like, would go have to go cross country over barbed wire fences, through this, through that, covered in cow shit, just to get to a gig.
And what was it like when you turn up to these things?
It was insane.
Proper good.
Literally insane. Really was insane. But you know, as I say, these things, they get big really quickly and they have to die. They can't maintain that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then what happens is people get jealous or people want to take over and there you go. And very quickly, those beautiful things are no longer beautiful.
I think a lot, lots of ways that you're lucky that you were whipped up into this madness of all this stuff. Well, what moments have there been where you're looking at your surroundings or what you're involved in thinking, do you have them pinch yourself?
I have them all the time. All the time. It's like people go, oh, what's the best part you've ever played? I'm like, it's not happened yet.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because they get better and better. They really do. Things just, I have these magical
even moments. Now still, like
even now, yeah. More so now than ever.
Yeah.
You know, I've got residency at High and I'm like, I'm there on a Friday and I'm thinking, what the fuck?
Yeah.
You know, at 56 to have an Ibiza residency.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't happen. You know, I truly believe that if I didn't have the 28 years of drug abuse in the middle, right, I don't know where I would be. Most of those people from that era are either stacking shelves now or doing retro gigs. Do you get what I mean?
I think and there's because you've got but then people who don't survive through that abuse. I mean, if you can come through to out of a side or something like that,
yeah,
it must make some things 10 times as special.
Well, you know,
it?
For me, I don't take things for granted anymore. I just think that it's all really special. I still struggle with imposter syndrome. I still believe that I don't deserve to be doing what I do sometimes.
Yeah. I struggle with the opposite of that.
Because you've got a little cock. Really? No.
I got nervous.
It's like, but you know what?
Adjust it out. Come on, show them that. For the Patreon.
But you got to say to you, it's that whole, like, you know, I had those pinch me moments. There's been, like, moments where I've been flying somewhere and I'm sitting up the front of the plane and not down the back where I used to be.
Yeah.
And those things change and I don't take that for granted. Do you know what I mean? I think, wow, fuck. Do you know what I mean? And then I get to where I'm going and I think everyone hates me. They're going to hate my music. They've flown me in for I'm going to be a biggest... And I have to start trying to compensate things to try and overcome that. Do you know what I mean? It's very bizarre. I still have those moments. And then I have moments where I'm in someone, like I did Donatella, like the first time I worked for Donatella, I was in her house and I'm like standing there and she comes in and she's like,
Donatella
Versace.
Not one of their turtles.
No.
I was thinking the same shit. That show, but I was like, I'm not going to ruin the flow of this conversation with you.
We both had fucking turtle wallpaper while this was going on. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, he met a turtle. Yeah. That was a psychosis one. Yeah, I do know.
But I was like in her house and I'm just thinking, what the fuck? How did I get here?
Yeah.
I mean, 5 years ago, I was picking up dog butts outside Vogue. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I knew they always had really big cigarette butts outside there because people would be smoking and have to rush back into it. That kind of mentality and suddenly being there and being shifted from being homeless with no teeth to actually doing Donatella Versace's house. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So did you go
mad?
Did you nick anything from Donatella Versace?
I didn't need to nick it. She'd give you it all. Yeah. That's the beauty of it.
So when did the stealing stop?
Oh, the stealing. Yeah. I'd love to steal now.
What's all that equipment, mate? Yeah,
the camera's in here.
I reckon when I started paying tax, it stopped. Oh, seriously. Do you know what I mean? Up to that point, I used to be like, I'll be in Sainsbury's and I'll think, I'm not paying for cheese.
Yeah.
And I put the cheese in my pocket.
Yeah.
No, I'd still love to. I'd still do it now if I could.
It's come up a lot on this podcast. Everyone says it's a buzz, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah. Like, fucking stealing the cheese.
We've said, of course, I'm taking the piss with prices. I've got to take the piss back.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. Totally. Yeah. You know, it's like filling up mini bars and all that shit. It's like keeping your finger on it, just like drinking it, filling up water and getting someone to fill it up and putting it back on.
Yeah.
So, because you've got like the 30 second divider thing if you take your finger off of it, the weight ones, all that shit. I love doing all that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So, you talk about the down and out years. Was you young and rich at one point?
Oh, I was really rich at one point.
And then you went down and out. Yeah. And then, so
like 85, in about 95, it was actually 94, I got my record deal and I bought a house in just off of, it was called The Cottage on Russell Square, just off Russell Square, in by Great Ormond Street, on Queen Square it was. Very good name, the Cottage, Queen Square, and I bought the house, you know, and I you know, they were the motorway years, like me, Danny Rampling, all of those guys, Sasha, were all going up and down the motorways, earning big money,
performing,
DJing. You know, we were the superstars of the time of that era. You know, suddenly the DJ became the oak of all, everyone, but all suddenly became.
Is this
gods.
Just before the super clubs?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we were making that kind of really extreme amount of money. And then I got my record deal, bought the house. I was like just fucking loaded.
Yeah.
Bearing in mind, I was also bankrupt at that point, but I'd never gone to face it. Because I'd lived in this guy called Paul Raymond owned Soho.
Yeah.
And I lived in all these houses and never paid rent for 3.5 years.
Yeah.
And they tried to make me bankrupt, like try to serve me with writs and shit.
Because
I did like 280,000.
The jazz mags and stuff like
that. Yeah, he owned all of that. Yeah, so he owned Paul Raymond's Review Bar.
Yeah.
He owned all
the windmill and all that.
Yeah, yeah. And he owned all the sex mags. So he owned all, that's what he made his money on porn.
That's anyway. How I used to make my money at school. I used to sell them at school. So. Not quite the same money.
Yeah, not same.
Kind of. I get it, though. I get the enthusiasm. But he, anyway, I was earning that kind of money. And then, of course, you know, that was just money that was going. And suddenly in about 95, my boyfriend died. And that kind of was the turning point for my addiction.
Is that what it was?
I think so. That was kind of where I suddenly thought, fuck this shit. Do you know what I mean? And just kind of went mental.
And what was the substance of...
Cocaine, always cocaine, yeah. You know, and it went from doing the amount that I was doing to triple the amount I was doing, you know.
You just don't sleep on that then?
Didn't sleep.
You just don't sleep?
No, 3 or 4 days at a time.
Well, you're just racking up lines all day long?
Yeah.
All day long?
On my own. And then friends would come around, then go out. If I had to work, which I did at weekends, I'd go work off my fucking face. And, you know, become a career. Going to work off my face become a career.
It's the work where you can do it, though, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. You know, and then I'd open like clubs, which were allowed to stay open all night, and do after hours parties and stuff. You know, because it fueled what I was doing.
Yeah. Did you have shit people around you as well?
Of course, you know, I had really good people around me. Of course, you have shit people around.
Yeah.
Because you know the level. You know, all the good people in your life, they're the ones that tell you no, stop doing what you're doing. You get rid of them. They get rid of them.
That's what I'm saying. Did you get rid of the
good people?
Of course
I did.
Right, yeah.
You know, you do something so bad to them that they don't want to know you.
Yeah.
And that's not something that happens by chance.
Yeah.
It's easier for them to not want to talk to you than it is for you to get rid of them. So we do like, you don't show up 5 times for dinner.
Yeah.
You let them down. You borrow money off them and don't give them back. All those stupid things, right?
Yeah.
And that kind of people, I can't have it with him right now.
Yeah.
They love you, but they can't have it with you because you don't want to listen to them. So they all go and then you replace them with party people. Those party people get replaced with lesser party people, but like, you know, and then suddenly you've got smackheads and crackheads in your house.
Yeah.
That's where it goes, because you're going down on this spiral. I used to describe it as like a really fast spiral, and all the good things go out and hit the wall.
Yeah.
And you're down at the bottom with all the piss.
Yeah.
Do you get what I mean? Yeah. Literally. And at the end of it, I was hanging out with the biggest, scummiest people in the world.
Are you aware of it as you're doing it, or you're just, don't give a fuck? You just
don't give a fuck. Yeah. And I kind of think, you know, I remember once my friend, who owns this club in Islington called The Egg. He came up to me one time and was like, what are you doing? I was like, what? He was like, the people you hang around with, you wouldn't piss on them if they were on fire. And I was like, they're my mates. What are you on about? And he was like, no, they're not, Tony. They're not. And I was like, yeah, they are. And they weren't. You know, and then, so when I actually got to that point where I went into rehab and I said to everyone I'm going into rehab, they were, you know, they all dispersed very quickly because you're no longer suddenly, you're no longer their meal ticket. You're no longer their ways and means for them to get more or, you know, you're no longer the party.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think the biggest thing you ever do in life is when you have that realisation that you're not the party, you're actually there to facilitate a party and help a party.
That's was you carrying the money still at that time? Is that what it was as well?
Well, you know, I would earn still big money, but I would end up in the worst places on earth because it made me feel better about myself.
Yeah.
I had to go to really low levels just to feel normal.
Yeah. So was you... With addiction, is that thing? Because at the beginning, was it I'm going to do this because it feels fun, and then does it switch into like to stop being sad?
There's a thin line between use and abuse, right?
Right.
When you cross that line, you start to abuse things. Yeah. So when it goes really wrong and really dark, I ain't got a problem with people that use drugs, and I'm quite jealous of them.
Yeah.
Because I can't use drugs because I will abuse drugs. I can't drink because I will abuse alcohol. Yeah. I don't have a stop button. Yeah. You know, I work a 12-step program, whatever, but I'm 15 and a half years clean because of the things I don't do, not the things I do, right? Yeah. And, you know, and people go, oh, don't you struggle with it when you're at work? And I'm like, no, because my life's so fucking good that I know if I have one drink, it's over. It's game over.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, you know, I'll have one drink, I'll just drink at dinner, or I'll just drink when I go out sociably. When I drink, I'm not sociable.
Yes.
Do you know what I'm saying, John?
Yeah.
There's nothing sociable about Tony when I drink.
Yeah.
You know, so therefore I choose not to do that stuff.
So when was the when was the turning point where it was like, I've got to sort this out? Because it got really bad, didn't it?
Oh, it got really, really bad. Yeah. I mean, I discovered a new drug towards the end after like about 14 years in, no, about 14 years in, about 26 years into using drugs, I found a new drug that I met a new boy friend, and he lived in the States, and he kept bringing it over with him. And it was a new drug that I hadn't tried before, and he was like, "Oh, you got to try this."
Yeah.
And I was like, I heard the horror stories about crystal meth.
Yeah.
And I was like, "Nah, it's not for me."
Yeah.
Until like 4 o'clock in the morning, I was like, "We got any of that meth?"
I got hold of you.
Yeah. Within like hours.
Yeah.
It wasn't a matter of like, oh, I only do it once. Within hours, I was clearing out people's houses. And,
fucking hell, mate.
Yeah, within hours. And you know, that's when, and within a year, I had no teeth left. I'd pulled them all
no
out.
No teeth?
I'd see it.
Why'd you put them out?
Because I had animals living in my mouth. That's what I
thought. Oh, you thought, yeah.
You know, the psychosis was like, I always bite my nails anyway, so I do. I had my fingers in my mouth constantly. And I would dig at my gums and pull at my teeth, and I'd work them all loose, and one by one I would break them off. And where I'd been so dehydrated and so fucking coke fucked for years, my gums had all receded, and they were always getting infected. Yeah. And then there was other factors, which you'll read about in the book, which kind of changed everything.
Yeah.
And when I got ill, without realising I was ill, thinking it was just the drink and the drugs, it took a really, really dark turn, and I'd become really, really ill. And then ended up in hospital on life support. Was in a coma for about 3 or 4 months. And at that point in time, I had full-blown AIDS without knowing it. They basically put me in a coma because it was in my brain. And my mum had the foresight to speak to one of the doctors there. They'd called all my family in to do the last rites because they said, look, you know, you've got to prepare yourself.
Yeah.
Because it had gone so severe and... it was really, you know, my mum had spoken to this guy called Professor Gazzard, who was like a very, very, he did all the research back in the day. And he said, we've got this drug that we want to try him on.
Right.
We're going to pump him full of it. Would you consent it? And, you know, my mum was probably one of the most incredible things that she's ever done in her life, gave the consent for them to do it. Because most mothers would be like, no, don't, because of the side effects.
Yeah.
My mum read the side effects. She was like, okay, can't be worse than what's going on right now.
Yeah.
And they pumped me full of these drugs. And within 3 weeks, I was fully awake and back to normal and wanting drugs again.
For fuck's sake.
I was outside the hospital with a gown on, with a drip in my arm, waiting for the dealer to arrive.
Yeah.
It's all in that book. But, but that couldn't stop me. Nothing could stop me doing drugs. Nothing. And then one night, keeping it short, one night I was in a club called The Cross, which was in King's Cross, funnily enough. And I was sitting rocking backwards and forwards, which is what I did normally, thinking I was like sane. I had one tooth left at the bottom of my mouth, and I was like playing with the tooth. And that day I'd already broken into my ex-boyfriend, into my boyfriend's house, because he'd kicked me out a week before.
Yeah.
And I waited for him, I hid in a port-a-loo across the road, the scaffolders were doing work. I waited for him to go out, and I burgled his house, stole his jeans and a change of clothes and his money, as you do. And off I went. And then he turned up that night at the club, and like that very guy who's just met outside, he was there. He was the person that came to me and went, James is here. And I was like, what? And he was like, he's here. And I was like, and for years, he'd gone to the clubs that I was always in and said to the people, you're going to find him dead on the floor. You know, what do you, you know, you're going to have blood on your hands. And I'd be like, bar him, he's fucking mental.
Yeah.
And he'd drag me out the DJ box and fight me all the time. The amount of times I've been strangled with my own fucking headphone wires, right, and black eyes that carried on DJing, like a super trooper.
Yeah.
You know, he turned up and I just thought, I can't deal with this tonight. And I remember looking at him thinking, please don't start.
Yeah.
And I thought, how's he in here? He's been barred. It was just one of those things, he should not have been there.
Right.
And he came over to me, and instead of like the usual, look at the state of you, you cunt, or punch him in the back of the head like you normally would, he literally just said, what happened to you?
Yeah.
And
man,
it makes me want to cry straight away.
Did that hurt? Or did that like cut and get a lot more than...
Of course.
Yeah. So it's,
it was the moment, it was, you know what it was? It was the moment that changed my life.
Was that it? That was the thing. That was the tipping point.
Yeah.
It's like when your parent goes, I'm not angry, I'm disappointed.
Yeah,
that's totally.
And it kind of, it really, it's because you're expecting.
Yeah,
anger.
I was expecting him to punch me in the head or stop fighting, and it wasn't.
And it was
there was
pity.
No judgment in it.
It was pity or like.
No, it wasn't even pity. Was it? You know what it was? It was there was compassion.
Compassion.
Yeah.
And pity's the wrong word, because pity I would have dined out on.
Yeah, yeah.
I love pity. I mean, I used to tell people my dad died every week. My dad died 6 times. Do you know what I mean? People go, didn't your dad die? I'm like, no, it's my stepdad. Yeah. I'd lie about everything, you know. Yeah. But so I was a big one for pity. I loved the pity pot, and I loved to be a victim. But, you know, that night there was compassion, and I hadn't seen that for a very long time from anyone. And I just think that that was the moment that the pilot light went back on. Because up to that point, all I ever thought about every day was dying. I thought about my own funeral, thought about planning my own funeral. I'd planned it all.
Yeah. Do you think there's certain times where, like, so, because I've suffered with addiction and stuff like that as well. Like, when you need the right moment for someone to show you compassion as well.
100%. It's like, a God-given. It's a God-given moment.
Sometimes your friends are there and they're doing the right things, but
you're not ready.
Yeah,
you have to be ready. There's no point, and I say this to people all the time: interventions don't work. They make people go underground. You know, we as addicts, we will tick boxes for you, and at the same time we'll be crossing boxes underneath the table. You know, this is what we do. We, you know, you try to do an intervention with someone, say, oh, you need to stop. You look at the state of you. You're going to fuck those people off like I did. We get rid of those people.
Yeah.
We don't want those people around us.
What should people do if they have got someone with it?
Oh, if someone's got a problem, you care about them, carry on supporting them.
Right.
Support them. You don't have to agree with what they do.
Yeah.
But just be there and ready for when they need that. Just make it very clear and just say, listen, we all know what's going on for you, all right? You know, do you understand what's going on for you? Have that conversation with them. Don't judge them. Don't say, oh, you're out of control, you look a mess, blah, blah, blah. Don't go on that level. Go there with compassion, show them love, right? You'll walk away from it thinking, I don't know why I just did that.
Yeah.
And then 6 months, 8 months, 9 months, you might get a phone call. Not always, but you might get that phone call and say, you know what? I really need to talk to you. Just always be at the other end of the phone for them. And be ready, because there will come a time when, even if it's on a Tuesday, where they go, I don't want to do this anymore. That's when you go in for the kill and you say, listen, I can help you now.
Yeah.
Let's take you and let's do this. I'll be with you all the way. Because, you know, addiction's the most loneliest place there is. Because what it does is it wants us locked in a room, killing ourselves. It wants us dead. It doesn't want us to take us on holiday. It doesn't want to take us out and buy new trainers. It wants us in a room, killing ourselves.
Yeah.
And that's what it wants. And that's the goal at the end of it. So, and we're always on our own, and we always think, no one gets me, no one cares. Show that you care. Just show that person some love.
I think that's very really valuable simple advice. See, people, really I don't think people know that. I don't think, because, I mean, I've had it in my family with addiction and stuff. I remember being young and just getting frustrated and angry, and it never worked. And it got worse, if anything,
yeah.
when you get like that. So I think that is a. I've never knew that.
Have you ever walked past someone on the street and they're begging and you've stopped to talk to them? Have you seen how grateful they are for that conversation?
Right, yeah.
Do you get what I'm saying, Joe? You know, it's not all people begging or homeless people want you to talk to them because they've got mental health or whatever. But there's always the one that you can see and you think, hang on, I'm going to talk to him. I'm going to show him some love. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And go and get him a sandwich and a bottle of cider or whatever it is they need at that moment. You know, instead of just walking away. Because you know what? The way I look at it is...
They're human
beings. They are, but also primarily, right... That homeless person that you just blanked on the street and looked at with disgust could actually one day save your child's life. End of story. I was that homeless person on the street. Right? Today I tried my best to help save people's lives. And that's the bottom line of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's all very well that we all walk by and we judge. Oh my God, look at them. They deserve to be there. Obviously don't want to get, you know, why don't get a job? Yeah. You're not in any state to get a fucking job.
I often find that when you go, say if you don't have any money, if you've got any change, you're sorry, mate, I don't, but if you actually acknowledge it, you always get a thank you, no worries.
Totally.
You get that, don't you? Do you know
what
I mean?
Yeah, totally. Because you know how many times they've been ignored?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just for you to acknowledge them is such a big thing. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Such a massive thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
But you're doing well now, though, Tone.
I'm doing very well.
You're looking all right, mate.
Yeah, oh, thanks.
Looking all right, having it, DJ.
And I'm not wearing baby blue.
I leave it alone, man.
And I couldn't leave it.
But it's funny because, this is a bit of different for this podcast.
Yeah, because all this is funny, innit?
Yeah, you know.
We're fucking depressed the whole...
it's fine, man, because there's more to... You know, we can have a deeper conversation. But the funny thing is when, we have, stock questions on this podcast, and it's have you ever shit yourself? What's the most embarrassing thing you've ever done? What's the most drunk you've ever been? And you have to literally, listen to the first two sentences of your book. It's about the time you shat yourself.
The book got beaten up. It was 6:30 in the morning, and I'd already shat myself. That fabric on the stairs, yeah. I shit myself all the time. I still shit myself. I'm fucking 15 and a half years old. The other day I was on the sofa and I just got ready to go out and I was sitting on the phone and I sharted.
Yeah.
I literally jumped up and I shit all down my beige jeans. And I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
I literally ran up. Yeah. You know, I'm one of these people that like to do new diets. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So this week's juicing. Or
Oh, no, of course.
Juicing has consequences.
Yeah. Tony's relapse. No, he always shits himself.
Yeah. Honestly, seriously.
<It's fine.
laughs> Seriously, you know. I'm a gay man. Kind of come second nature. But, you know, it's just shitting yourself. Yeah. That's another one that people always struggle with telling about. Who hasn't sharted?
It's literally the point of this podcast that I was showing. What I'm trying to do, right? We live in a world, it gets a bit deep. I know it's just people talking about shit themselves and stupid stories, but we do live in a world that's so segregated. Everyone's against each other all day.
Oh my God.
As human beings, we've all shit ourselves. We've all embarrassed ourselves. So let's get on and talk about it.
Listen.
And it's like a unifying thing.
I do it all the time. You know,
shit in the pants is a unifying thing.
My worst one is pissing. So pissing's my worst one. So I will drink water or drink Coca-Cola or whatever I'm at work. I have to stop the car 20 times on the way back. I'm terrible for it. As soon as I get in a car, I'm like, I've got to go piss. Got to go piss. And I'm very blessed these days. I have a driver who drives me everywhere for work. And I'm like, oh, you've got to start getting bottles in the car. You've got bottles in the car. Because I used to jump out. I'd pull over. I've got a really good action. Oh, no, I'll tell you this story. You'll like this one. So this is the biggest name-dropping shit story you're going to get, right, ever on here. So you might as well fucking roll in it. Like a dog rolling in fox shit, right? Literally. So I was in Miami. I went over to do David Beckham's party for a launch with Adidas. So they flew me over. And it's me, Pharrell, Dave Beckham, and a guy called Dave Gardner, who's Dave Beckham's manager, best friend. Anyway, we just done the party at Soho House, and we were all going off to this part to Prada. We're having a party down further down South Beach. So we're all in the car, and you know when you get that feeling in your stomach where someone's punched you in the stomach, and you think, "Oh my god, I'm going to shit myself." You know that stomach cramp feeling. You know the one where you've just got
warning.
The worst cramp, and you're like, "Any minute now, I'm going to erupt." And you sit there trying to hold it, and you're like, "It's just going to explode." Right? So I'm sitting there and Dave Gardner's sitting next to me and I'm like, Pharrell's in the front and Dave Beckham's outside and I'm like, I'm going to shit myself. And he's like, what? I said, shit. He's like, what? I'm like, Paul, we need to stop the car. I'm going to shit myself. And we hadn't moved. We were in traffic. And, you know, like there's a bit of grass in the middle of the road with bushes, and then on the freeway, and then the other side, there's like in between the motorway. Yeah. I just flew out the car, threw the door open, went out. Luckily, a gay man, I know how to aim. I literally jumped into the bush, right? I literally shat, like, right? Right, wiped my arse in leaves and got back in the car. And I'm sitting there, right? And Dave Beckham goes, "Can you smell shit?" And I'm like, "What?" He's like, "Can you smell shit?" And I'm like that, sitting there, "Nah." And obviously, David told everyone in the car. Farrell's like, "Hey, man, I can smell shit." And I'm like sitting there thinking, fuck. I said, "Would you get up? Do you have a shit? I can smell shit. You're covered in shit. You're taking the fucking shit." And I'm like sitting there like this, sitting there thinking, "Oh my God." And it starts again. And I'm like, so anyway, they're all like doing shit jokes and everything. Really shit jokes. And worse than shit jokes than your jokes, right? And he gets out. So anyway, I'm sitting in the car and I'm like, they're all going, I said, "I need to go back to the hotel. I'll meet you at the party." So they all go in and I'm sitting in the car and I'm like holding my stomach and it's bubbling away, ready to go again. And I'm like sitting there and a woman's like, "Yeah, so did you come to Miami?" And I'm like, "Listen, sweetheart, I really need to get to the hotel." She's like, yeah. And she started talking to me and I literally started feeling it coming out. And I was like, I'm like, "How much further to the hotel?" She's like, "Oh, it's about 10 yards. It's there, sir. I thought you were waiting for me to drop you off at the front door." I ran, and as I'm running through the entrance to the Edition, have you ever been to the Edition in Miami?
No.
All white.
Right.
All white. Everything's white marble. Yeah. I'm running through the foyer.
not a good combo for what you're
I'm running through the combo for the foyer, and all down my legs, all over the floor, all over the white marble floor, through my shorts. Shat all over the reception. And I literally ran to the lift and there was like a trail of shit behind me to the lift. And it was one of those shits that really stank. Because it was like, I'd had prawns at lunch. Like shrimp. And like literally, I was in my room. Anyway, I got showered and got dressed and went to the party and they were all like, just like, "What happened?" I was like, "I don't, man." And that was it. But that's my shit joke. But pissing, I've got, I literally can't hold it when I want to go. I think I'm at that age. I drink so much like coke and shit that I like literally have to piss. I'll be DJing and I'm pissing in a bottle like that all the time and then putting it underneath the decks for the next DJ to drink. But like it's, you know, I do, but
free apple juice.
Yeah, literally, yeah, I know that. Carrot juice back in the day. But yeah, no, pissing and shitting. Not a problem.
Right, that is it this week for the public episode. But if you want to hear the rest of my conversation with DJ Fat Tony, then you can listen on Patreon. We ended up getting right into this conversation and recording for an hour and a half. So if you want to hear the rest of the interview, head over to patreon.com/JackSkipper and you can listen to that there. You'll also get access to my weekly podcast that I do with my brother. Let's get to the extra good stuff. You'll get my solo podcast and early access to the main podcast. You get all that for £3 a month. That's, you know, say half a lager a month. And any pledges made go back into the podcast so we can, you know, keep growing, keep developing it. I'm enjoying it. I hope you are too. And thank you to everyone who signed up so far. We're building a lovely community for fans of the podcast. So thank you. And thank you guys for listening. Thank you to anyone who's reviewed, shared, given the 5 stars. It all really helps, and I really appreciate it. Right, that's all for this week. We'll be back next week. See you all soon. Take care.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA.
TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more. Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.